It's Sunday morning. Time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and thank you for joining me. As I promised last week, I was going to start off with the discussion on the Boundary Waters Quetico area, which is an iconic area for those of us in the Midwest and the Minnesota-Quebec line, but also iconic for around the country for its natural beauty. And the headline I'm going to read off is, Boundary Waters vote provides fuel to raise money, but the reality is far from the posturing. So about a month ago, I commented that the Boundary Waters was being opened up for mining, maybe, and that there were a lot of people opposing it, and that it was one of those situations where this was likely to end up in court battles. And some of my comment was made based upon the mailings and information coming from environmental groups. And then as I've dug into this further, and I keep getting solicitations to send money, I spent a little more time, and Chris Dorsey, who I've had on the air many times, shared some thoughts with me, and actually he wrote a pretty thoughtful piece on this, which I want to share with you, which I think things puts into perspective. And he starts off by saying, you'd think listening to the loudest voices in the outdoor community lately that the Boundary Waters had just been handed over to a mining company with a bow on top. Fundraising emails, social posts, and urgent alerts to send money have painted a picture of imminent, irreversible damage that's about to be done to the Boundary Waterways. But things couldn't actually be further from the truth on that. Even with a top level of research on this, one should know that what the environmental groups is what they're doing often, trying to raise money by blowing something out of proportion. So let me just explain exactly what's going on. And I'm sure many of you listening this morning have been to the Boundary Waters or have heard about the proposed destruction of the Boundary Waters. All that happened is that a small procedural rule was changed. It didn't change anything else. So under the Biden administration, they put a 20-year cap. In other words, for the next 20 years, there could be no more mineral exploration in the Boundary Waters area. The Trump administration simply withdrew that executive order. As one president can issue an executive order, the next president can undo the executive order. The Trump administration withdrew the executive order that shut down for 20 years any new mining permits in the Boundary Waters. It did not shut down existing permits. It only said there would be no new permits. And as Chris Dorsey points out, that distinction matters because it did not change any of the laws, and it did not change any of the processes that need to be gone through for moving ahead with any kind of mining in the Boundary Waters area. And I'm not on the show this morning or ever going to pretend to be the person who should decide whether or not we should have mining in the Boundary Waters area. We have all kinds of laws and permits that are going to go forward. But I think I am the person who says, when are the environmental groups going to stop trying to raise money off of an unsuspecting public who generally trusts their motives? But at the end of the day, the motives often are, give us more money so we can sue more people to give us more money. And in this case, the Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, and many organizations that are trying to advance conservation through litigation, this is just an example of what happens. So no, lawmakers from both parties are involved with this. But the process for bringing about more mining in the Boundary Waters area has not changed, and it has to go through extensive legislative review, and it has to be grounded in science. All of that's in place. But that context is entirely different from the current wave of outrage that's being given. Instead, what's being put around the country, and in fact, some members of the Roosevelt family got engaged in this, is that it's a vote for a green light to begin mining. That's not true at all. It's not a vote to begin green light. And I'm not here shilling for the mining groups. I'm not doing that at all. I'm just simply saying these are the facts. The repeal of the executive order simply opens the possibility, as was always the case, for leasing. It does not approve a mine. It doesn't fast track any development. It doesn't bypass any environmental safeguards. And it doesn't even guarantee, as Chris Dorsey said, that a viable project will even happen. Furthermore, any proposal for mining in the Boundary Waters has a much bigger hurdle to occur. The state of Minnesota retains its own permitting authority, a fact that has been absolutely not mentioned in any of the pleas for money to send to stop the mine. The state has the power to approve or deny any permits, regardless of the federal position. And given the political makeup of Minnesota's current leadership, and possibly into the future, it's pretty difficult to imagine a scenario in which a large-scale mining project in this region is ever going to be approved. So that's the fact. In the hypothetical world, federal agencies can sign off tomorrow and the mine can be built, but the state has the final approval. And as is true in other states, they're not very popular. So there's not going to be a mine built in the Boundary Waters of Minnesota anytime soon. It's going to be decades if it happens at all. The only thing that happened was the undoing of an executive order which said we won't even consider a mine for 20 years. And the Trump administration said, well, that's not realistic. If there is a mine to be considered, it should go through the process. And I'm not advocating what the Trump administration did. I'm just saying that the communications of this is a great example of how the environmental community, which is different than the conservation community, that's for sure, how the environmental community takes these issues and tries to raise money off them, while the conservation community takes these issues and tries to solve problems. And I think there's a huge distinction, as I've made many times, between the conservation community, which is really founded on the principles of Teddy Roosevelt and Aldo Leopold, and the environmental community, which is more in the John Muir Society, Sierra Club Society world. It's not to say it's wrong, but theirs is preservation versus management. And the preservation of our natural resources has been fabulous, but if we don't have management of our natural resources, we have long-term ecological problems, which I'm going to talk about when I come back from the break. So the Boundary Waters is absolutely a national treasure. And the scrutiny over any potential industrial activity near it is not only justified and warranted, it's absolutely essential. But as Chris Dorsey said in his article, there's a difference between vigilance and exaggeration. And when organizations default to alarmism, framing incremental procedure changes as existential threats, they not only risk eroding their credibility, they also cause divisiveness that doesn't need to exist. So I hope you all take me at my word on this. And if you don't, please do your own research. And if you find anything I'm saying is inaccurate, please let me know. The Boundary Waters is not going to be open for mining. There have been no changes in the laws that govern mining in the Boundary Waters. And the state of Minnesota holds the trump card in that it has the final say as to whether or not any mining takes place in the Boundary Waters, and that has always been the case. I love going to the Boundary Waters. I love going to Quetico. It's an international treasure. The canoeing is the best in the world. The fishing is among the best in the world, and it's a place where you can get off the radar and paddle in the silence of a canoe. And as it said about canoeing, a canoeing is really when you put the paddle in the water and you take a paddle, eventually what you do is you create a ripple, and then that ripple goes away. A canoe leaves no trace. The Boundary Waters is absolutely special for being the wilderness it is. And I have a feeling it's going to continue to be a wilderness for a very, very long time. So the next time you get an appeal to send money because it's under grave threat, that appeal is not valid. That's my view, at least. I'll be back with much more on the Great Outdoors Show in just a moment, and I'm going to talk about what I saw this week in Portland, Oregon, and some of the work with the U.S. U.S. Forest Service is taking place. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter here on WGN Radio and hope you are enjoying the show. I'm going to now move you out to the Pacific Northwest where I was this week. Discussions with the World Forestry Center and others regarding the use and management of our public lands, in particular the use of our U.S. Forest Service lands. And I come away once again with the opinion that you've heard me view before, but it's really fresh in my mind from just having been there. The question is, why are our private forested lands so well managed? And why are our public forested lands so poorly managed? And when you're in Portland, Oregon, you're in the center of the Pacific Northwest timber industry. Portland was built on timber. The timber barons, the great philanthropy that took place, all of that is based out of Portland. It was and is the epicenter for timber in the Northwest. It used to be pretty much the epicenter for timber in America, but it certainly is the epicenter for timber in the Northwest. The Douglas firs, all the huge trees, all the way up into the Tongass, into Alaska, it all emanates out of Portland, and it still does. So there's a great frustration in the West with how the U.S. Forest Service over decades has mismanaged our forests. The most obvious is wildfires, which we see even in Chicago in the summer, the smoke coming from the West, sometimes from Canada. We've had it last summer again. We've had it in Washington, D.C., and the people who live in the West every summer are suffocated with forest fires. That is, forest fires were natural. Apocalyptic forest fires were never natural. And what we've done through decades of not clearing underbrush and not managing forests for the sustainability and for the health of the environment, but rather just letting trees grow and thinking nature is going to take care of itself, has left this inferno waiting to happen, a tinderbox of hundreds of millions of acres that has still yet to burn. So if you think the forest fires have been bad in recent years, it's only touched a fraction of the landscape, nowhere near, no, not even close to 30% of the landscape, I think, has even been touched by forest fire. It's coming, and that is coming mostly on federal forested lands. So after the terrible fires in Oregon of 5 years ago, which wiped out 300,000 acres just south of Portland in the Willamette Valley, now we're getting a regrowth. The regrowth is of invasive species trees because the U.S. Forest Service, by and large, would not permit timber companies to come in and cut the dead timber from fires or the timber that was laying on the ground and remove it and to reforest those areas with trees that are native to the Pacific Northwest. Instead, that dead timber lays on the ground and trees that are invasive to the Pacific Northwest, spruce trees in particular, are blue spruce, are populating the hillsides all over the Willamette Valley. And that is not good for wildlife, and it's not good for the future of timber. So when I was meeting with individuals this past week, their primary concern is, when will the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, when will the U.S. Forest Service change its policies to aggressively manage our forests to minimize disease and to increase the cutting of timber for the management and healthiness of our forests, health of our forests, but also wildlife. Whether you're a grouse, a deer, an antelope, an elk, songbird, you depend on healthy forests for your survival. And forests that are choked with undergrowth and have not been managed are not healthy. And instead, they're diseased. And through the eons of time, fire came through. Fires were not enormous because the forest periodically burned. You didn't have this incredible fuel. But now, because fires have not burned for so long, because we suppressed them all, the federal lands are infernos waiting to happen, while the private lands, which are intensively managed, are not infernos waiting to happen. But they, too, are impacted by these huge fires that are occurring because they're so large in their volume that even private lands being well managed end up burning to some extent as well. So it's the number one issue in the American West as we enter a summer, which right now is predicted to be hot and dry. The lack of precipitation this winter in the American West is a big factor. And sitting here in Chicago, we're going to see that smoke. And we only look no further, need no look further than the U.S. Forest Service to say, why can't we get our forests under management? And it's not going to take, it's going to take decades, rather. It's not something we can do overnight. And I know the current regime at the U.S. Forest Service is working very hard to change longstanding rules so that we can have healthier forests that are not diseased. On the other hand, waiting to stop them are a whole host of environmental litigation that doesn't want to simply see anything cut, even if it's a sick, old, diseased tree. And it's a colossal problem for America. And while we don't think about it every day in Chicago because we don't live in the Pacific Northwest, when we have smoke this summer, and we probably will, and the quality of our air is bad to breathe and it creates health issues, we can think about this. It doesn't have to be this way, but we have to get Congress and the U.S. Forest Service to change their policies, not only for our sake, but for the sake of all the trees and the wildlife that depend on our huge national forests in the West. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.